Nick, if you couldn't use personas when you were working on Star Wars, would it have been successful or not? Welcome to Game Makers. The game industry has been talking more and more about the use of personas recently than I can ever remember, especially in the free-to-play game development scene. So I wanted to talk to some real experts who have actually deployed the use of personas in game development for very successful games. So who would that be? Well, today we're speaking to Josh Rivers, who used persona analysis while at CCP working on EVE Online and is currently the head of UX research at Solsten. This is a company blending psychology and AI to help studios create player-centric experiences. And we also have Nick Reinhardt, game director at Electronic Arts, and who previously used persona analysis on Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes, a game that has been a pretty huge success. What did they do? How should you use personas in your own game development? How impactful is it? Stay tuned to this very cerebral conversation. Now, to be honest, this conversation did make my head hurt a little bit, just because of how complex the topic is. But it's definitely worth listening to get some great insights from these guys who are about as deep as you can get with this specific approach. Stay tuned. Today's episode is sponsored by Data.ai to access estimates for rankings, downloads, revenue, usage, or engagement for millions of apps on the App Store and Google Play. Sign up for Data.ai. I thought we could first start by just talking about the definition of personas. So for you guys, when you think about personas, what does it mean to you? How do you guys define it? And maybe starting with you, Nick.
Yeah, personas are, you know, it's interesting. I would say, like, not to stall on the question too much, but I would say that, like, it's still defining and redefining itself. When I first started, I started work as a data scientist. And so a lot of it was very related to the behavioral aspects of what players were doing. And then there's a whole component of it that's consumer sort of CSAT or like, you know, consumer survey related. And that's a part of it too. And I feel like we're in this, not necessarily this third wave, or maybe it's the third wave of my own personal experience of like the blending of those two things together. And so what that means then is that and it also depends, I think, contextually on where the game is in its life cycle. If you're standing up a prototype, you're probably really trying to figure out like what is the general mass appeal of it versus when you're actually in early production, you're trying to understand what is and isn't resonating. And then finally, in sort of the late stages of a game, you know, moving from regular work to sunsetting, you're talking a lot about who is coming and going as installs change, as the demographics change. And so I don't think I really answered the question so much as muddied the waters and said, like, I think there's a lot of different parts to it and the way that you think about it. And so personas to me are, depending on the life cycle of the game, what are the different types of behaviors that you're trying to understand in a player base relative to the needs of the business where you're trying to start it off at that time. And so that's a very wide remit, but it also means then that there is no one size fits all in the way that we think about personas. You have to be very thoughtful about what you're trying to orchestrate relative to your own like sort of broader causal logic model of what the game is supposed to be doing at that time.
I think Nick is correct, right? Like we're in a phase where personas are being defined and redefined, and what's useful in what particular moment changes based on both the team and what kind of data is available to that team. I think Nick kind of got at the point here, but one thing that's very important when it comes to personas is what data you're using to define those personas, and I've seen that done in about 1,000 different ways. At Solsten, we use psychology as the background for that, and I find that really powerful, partly because of what Nick was pointing towards, right? Which is that in certain stages, you're looking for resonance, in other stages, you're looking to understand kind of the behavior of a particular audience. And by using something that's a little bit more stable over time, those kind of psychological traits, I think we're able to kind of define personas in a way that is robust and transferable, but doesn't shift based on the phase that you're looking at. So we like to define them using people's psychology, like I've said about 1,000 times now. But what I think is important to flag is it's not just the element of the brain. It's also things like what kind of IPs are super resonant with somebody. Whenever we're trying to capture something like an audience through personas, you're inherently creating sort of different parts of an audience. You're inherently creating different segments of that audience. And so what's critical is to think about how you separate them out. I think Nick pointed towards, right, CSAT and the behavior, and that's an important aspect of that. But what do we look at as well that's going to distinguish these different personas from one another in a way that's actually useful? So that's what's really critical to me. One sort of issue that I've seen with personas that are based solely on something like CSAT or solely on something like behavior is that they're not useful over time. So you have to constantly change those personas or shift how you're creating them. And I think that's where we get into some problematic territory. So yeah, all of that to say, again, I actually think I've also kind of muddied the waters here a little bit, but whenever it comes to actually defining personas, it's very useful to look at things that are going to be stable over time and things that are actionable for a team. So something that's going to help them whenever it's coming to that phase of creating a game that's resonant, looking at a prototype, for example, what could we do differently? How do we prioritize features in this space? And then ultimately, once you've got that live game, thinking about something like, how do we look at drops and retention? How do we look at engagement? So all of that to say, yeah, there's a lot of different ways to go about it. What's important to me is that whenever we are defining personas, we're using something that is rooted in data, rooted in science, and is actionable for the team that's working with them.
Okay, so maybe for someone kind of simple-minded like myself, I think it'd be helpful if you could provide some specific examples, like some of the types of methodologies that I have seen, or like you see some of these personas around, whether it's Bartles or psychological types, or the Nick Yi motivational model or whatever. Like, can you guys maybe provide a few examples of the way that you are thinking about personas, and then maybe compare and contrast to some of those more well-known types of persona classification methodologies?
I think the way that we work with personas and the data sets that we're using is really rooted in those psychological traits I mentioned. So The approach that we've taken is to psychologically assess audiences of people. Now, whenever we're looking at a live game, we're actually running a psychological assessment with the player base of that live game. This
and
is about
you do that, you're doing that through surveys, or how are you doing that?
It looks like a survey, but it's really important to distinguish between what's a psychological assessment and a survey. So it's a survey tool. It's distributed using a survey platform. It would look like a survey to a player. But an assessment is actually, scientifically validated, reliable. There's certain patterns of constructing that are really rooted in how you get somebody to answer openly and honestly about their own approach to the world and their own kind of cognitive take on the world. So once we've kind of got that out of the way, it's important to think about how we distribute that. And what we're doing is actually distributing it within a game, usually. So what players do is they go through and they would actually answer a set of psychological assessment items. There's around 100 or so. 60 items are really tied directly to the cognitive think space, and a couple others are tied more to things like general user experience, as well as like feature resonance, IP resonance, all of that. So once we take this set of data, we're actually plugging that into an AI algorithm that is then clustering people based on psychologically unique traits. So it's unique per audience. I think this is the other thing that is really important about the persona work that I like to engage with, is that you have to tailor it towards the audience you're working with, be that the target audience or the live game audience. And that's what our AI does. So then it'll actually pull out those personas and can be anywhere from, two all the way up to eight or so different unique kind of psychological humans within an audience. That's the persona work that I enjoy working with. I've also seen work in this space based, purely on demographics, based purely on behavior. And it goes back to the methods behind that are a little vague, a little hard to work with. I will say that I really like Nikki's work in the motivation space. I think it's awesome, fantastic work. I would augment that, though, with a little bit more on the personality side, a little bit more on the values side. And that's what we do at Soulstone, is just add a little bit more dimension to that kind of way of segmenting out personas.
How would you augment that? You're saying you're adding kind of your stuff on top of his stuff. Like, how does that work? What's an example of that?
Yeah, great point. It's not adding our stuff on top of Nick's stuff. So Nick has a totally different model that he works with than we do. We also gauge motivations, though we do that from a more general psychological element versus I think Nyx is really focused on kind of gameplay elements. And what we like to add on top of that is things like values, things like personality, things like hopes and aspirations. Personas ultimately to me are a tool to connect a game team, a development team, or a marketing team, or anybody really working on a game with a broader audience. And if we're only looking at the motivations of why that audience is playing any game or your game specifically, I think we're losing part of the picture. It's really important to understand that people are more than just the motivations that kind of get them into a game space. So to get to your question, what are we specifically looking at? We're looking at about 12 different trait categories. It's actually why Solstheim used to be called 12 traits. But of those categories, what's really critical is, of course, motivations. It's important to understand what gets somebody playing a game, but also things like personality. So what kind of a human are they? Are they particularly empathetic? Are they, you know, kind of competitive? Are they looking to kind of dominate within a space, be more social, connect with people? But then also things like, you know, hopes and aspirations. What does this person want from life? What do they want from not just a game, but also from their general experiences? And I think that helps us to connect more with people on a human level using personas.
So Nick, it'd be great to hear your perspective in terms of like specific examples or things of that nature.
Yeah, sure. So I've worked with Solstheim previously, full disclosure there. And so I've seen those sorts of personality matrices before, and everything that Josh said, like that has been my experience with it as well. We leverage that in a prototyping environment where I am, and we've discussed about how we deployed into some of our live games as well. Other ways I've seen it used, personas is that, and I can only give away so much, I'm part of, while I work for the studio Capital Games, that's a part of the larger Electronic Arts umbrella. And so EA has a set of, I'm going to say proprietary sort of views of the way that they think about players. It's more along the lines of that we would think about like Bartle types, but it's different. It's more specific in the ways that we think about games. Those are good, and I'm not going to say that they're bad, but I would say like they're good for some very specific vectors. There's some other things that I think like they miss out on, and about the way that you like sort of aggregate that data. And then the other ways we've done personas is, like I said earlier, through behaviors. One of the ways I did that when I worked in data science, which I no longer do, I'm a game director on EA now, but the way that showed up is that we would actually just look for markers of players' interactions with different games, and we would create behaviors around and then evaluate those behaviors like very deeply, and we would come up with narratives and the ways that we say that it worked. And so like decomposing that, there are sort of these like more formal psychometric methods that we see, panel surveys, et cetera, of how you go through and analyze people relative to their prescribed or spoken behaviors of what they're going to do. And then I've also seen behaviors inside of the game as like tracking what players actually do and how that plays out. And a lot of times what I find is that each one of them has a value that is good. But a lot of times it's sort of no single tool solves your problem. It is the quilt of them together and the culture of your leadership and how they think about using those things that I think is what really drives it. And not to pontificate too long on it, but to say, you know, I used this term earlier and we talked a lot about it in Capital Games, having this notion of like a causal logic model, which means really just trying to break out why does the game work in all the different ways that it does. It's kind of like a broader, I use the term economic, not to say like everything is business, but economic as a means of motivations and incentives, et cetera. And how you take that and compartmentalize it into modules, and then using these different sort of frames of knowledge and information, begin to update sort of the engine room of your model and begin to refine it over time. Really no different than we would see in any academic setting where we have a hypothesis, we gather data, we improve that model, and then we make the next step. We stand on the shoulders of ourselves or other giants, and we try to move the ball forward from there.
Right. And just so for both me and perhaps the audience, an example of a behavior would be something like what you would do in the game, like you would attack or try to be like a killer type, or you would be like a farming type, or things like that. Would that be an example of behaviors?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah, and apologies. Like I live and breathe this stuff so much that I make a lot of gross assumptions. But yeah, it's basically taking the actual behaviors. You attack so often, you do some other behavior, you farm so often, you are making some sort of move towards collecting a character, etc. We try to contextualize all that as like a set of behaviors that are taken in game and how they, through different clustering or different sorting and grouping methods, figure out the ways that those players connect to one another.
Okay. And Josh, you guys at Solsten, you guys are using data to kind of build out your persona types based upon personality, but based upon the personalities, does it also get driven to some kind of behavioral persona type, or is it a personality type?
Yeah, so we're working with more than just personality. I want to make sure we kind of start there, that we actually look at the whole psychological profile of people. So personality is one dimension, but there's 11 other categories of kind of psychological, you know, profile that we look towards. I'm happy to dive a little bit more into that, but if we kind of take that at face value, we do see things like behavior kind of informed by that. What's interesting, though, is that sometimes you see the same behavior for different motivational, personality, or psychological reasons. So what we like to do, and it actually gets to Nick's point, is we've kind of taken this hypothesis of, why are personas useful? Well, because they unlock connection to the audience and an understanding of how to kind of target, develop, you know, test within a prototype space. What could we do to make that even more robust? Well, we could get to kind of the why behind some of this behavior. Sometimes that behavior is the same, sometimes it's different. And what's intriguing is when it is the same behavior, but for very different reasons. So for example, we see people engage with social tools or social elements of a game for very different reasons sometimes. Some folks are looking to form a strong connection with other human players and other people online. Some people are looking to kind of gain status and have kind of a status achievement. It's more motivational, right? But there's also aspects of personality and specifically of hopes and aspirations that people think through psychologically that also inform that. So it definitely is a bit behavioral, but it's it's not just behavioral.
Got it. So like a example persona type from Solsten might be like a status seeker or something like that.
Yeah. It's pretty close. It would be more like looking at the predominant trait of somebody. So let's say somebody is, for example, really oriented and becoming maybe like a leader type within a community. We've kind of identified specific traits that inform the fact that this person's going to want a leadership role or want to at least engage with a community as a leader. So that's an aspect of it. But I will caveat this by saying that psychology is quite complicated. So it also means that you can interpret those personas in different ways. What's useful there is, going back to what I was saying, it's helpful at every step of development. So perhaps you're looking to kind of think about your, you know, your marketing, then you'd want to tap into kind of singular traits that are going to stand out there. But if you're looking to actually create a robust, sort of complicated virtual world or set of features, you'd want to take those apart and look at the individual elements.
Great. Now, one aspect I probably, and maybe we could talk about it later, but that does seem interesting between the both of you, is that it seems like your persona types are largely data driven. I do know a number of folks at, you know, pretty successful game studios that are more conceptually driven in their persona types, and especially from the perspective of new game development earlier on. We don't have a live game. Josh, you had mentioned that you actually try to like actually take live players and run, you know, not surveys, but however, whatever you're calling that, to get inputs from players. But let's talk about applications. And you know, one would be when you're developing a new game and you're trying to determine, like, use personas to kind of try to figure out what features are best or how to adapt features for a new game. And then I think when you have a live game, there's other type of applications. But maybe you guys could talk about, from your perspective, what are the primary applications that you have been using personas for?
Yeah, and again, I've got, it's not across the same product, but I've had a chance to use these sorts of notions of personas and data in a couple different contexts. And so in a prototyping environment, what was useful is that we had a hypothesis about sort of a combined genre perspective experience that we were thinking about. And what that resulted in is that we had a sort of like set of key mechanics, and we believed that it had some overlap in these genres, et cetera. But we actually didn't really have, we had a lot of like, I think, clear ideas about how those things worked independent of one another, but we actually didn't understand like what it would look like blended. And so we engaged with Solston previously on working on one of these things, and that helped give us a better sense of what the overlap was or wasn't. And I think that just as much as not just confirming our biases, but also like sort of going against like and saying, no, that doesn't work. I think there was also some interesting things that we took away from that about the way that it blended in ways that we had unintended. And so what that ended up doing largely for us, I think, really helped us begin to set the way that we were thinking about marketing the game. It gave us another sense of kind of what our feature scaffold was going to be, i.e. which feature came after which, or like what sort of IPs we'd want to adopt, et cetera. Another context was shortly after launch, I was the live producer on Galaxy of Heroes, Star Wars, and we used a lot of, and this is an instance where we used internal data inside of Electronic Arts, sort of closer to CSATs, et cetera. But what that ended up helping us really understand is that, so there's this prototype space, what people could we potentially attract? And now you have just freshly launched, what people have we attracted? and then you're living in this world with who do we have and why do we have them? I think it's really easy to sort of paint in broad strokes and say like, you know, we're going to build the game for the players we have, but there's like so much nuance into it is that it's not just, you know, it's not just like saying, oh, these are PvE players, all features moving forward are PvE features. There's a lot more interesting, I think, in sort of the nature of we have 25% of this type of player and 25% of this type of player and 50% of this one, and that they all monetize in different ways. And so it didn't just even turn into like raw feature selection. Oh, we got more PvPers, so we're going to do this. It became even more interesting as saying, like, let's imagine bulk of the players are social oriented, or the bulk of the players are this. What is a blended feature that will satisfy both to some amount? And so I would actually say that there was a lot of really interesting ways in which we thought about blending personas and feature types, et cetera, and the ways that we would think about that, especially in the early days of Galaxy of Heroes. I'm also early days. I have a project that's about to release for Lord of the Rings. We're starting to do some of that thinking as well. But even thinking about late stage games like Galaxy of Heroes, as it is, and some of the last stuff I was doing, you know, a lot of it then turned into maximization. And maximization here could mean monetization, but could also mean engagement. And so I think we thought a lot about now that we have burned in the. So again, what players could we have? What players did we attract? The players that we have right now, what are we trying to do to keep them satisfied over a long period of time? And again, it's nuanced, but I think explicitly different than sort of like, what is our feature scaffold? These players have all burned in. They've got long-form retention, long-form behaviors. And so necessarily what is bringing them satisfaction has changed as well. And so the way that we then reinvestigate like an early persona, hi, I'm new to the game, wide-eyed and bushy-tail, where are we going? Versus to, I've been with you all for a while. I want to keep hanging out with you. What are you doing to keep me engaged? That's a very different set of questions and a very different sort of expression inside of the game level as well. And so anyway, again, I'm kind of pushing my model of thinking around it. But again, that's very much from like the game dev side of it and thinking about it in terms of the game's life cycle and how, again, ultimately we're reacting to the players that are inside system. But how do we craft experiences that are really good for them? Because ultimately, live games especially are fundamentally, an extension of customer service. That you decide to spend your time with us, how can we make sure that that time feels good and that it's worthwhile to you?
Right. And Nick, just so I understand, and, you know, sorry if I'm being a little simple-minded here, but like, so you mentioned that, in Star Wars, there might have been like a hybrid of different kind of features or things like that. And so was this ahead of development? So you guys are trying to think about what to develop. And then if so, then how did you test that without players or data? Or did you come up with like concepts and try to test those concepts with people who you thought would be potential players? Like how did that actually kind of execute?
So like that's a tricky environment, right? Like, I mean, especially when you think about it from a game dev perspective, like your return on investment on like potentially building like a pseudo feature and then seeing if people are going to like it. And then in addition, like, you know, players, there's one of the things that I think I really that video games have some capacity for A/B testing these sorts of behaviors, but there's also a number of things that are really difficult to A/B test. So for instance, like long form behaviors associated with again, I come from a character collection role-playing game space. So like raids, or is this the sort of way that people want to play with their characters for a long period of time? You actually don't learn that until you actually like they've lived with it for a long period of time. And so the way that we would test these is we've gone through a series of like small form focus groups. We've done testing of like we've done paper prototyping and played that with ourselves, etc. We've seen how it's going to work. A lot of times that analysis, at least for the moment, ends up being retrospective. And again, what that ends up doing then is that we treat each feature as an opportunity for knowledge creation. And then we like perform like sort of deep retrospectives, not just on, hey, did we hit our business KPIs, but we also are performing retrospectives on our analyses that led us to that place. Where did this, how did this thing actually build out? Did it drive those in the ways that we did? And did it drive them in the way that we expected to? Were the right levers pulled by players? Or, you know, as I think Josh sort of hinted at in some ways, you may still arrive to a set of behaviors, but the pathway, the way the players headed to it were different. And so, again, I think I'm sort of dancing around the question. I promise it's not. It's just, again, I feel I want to give it the space because it's incredibly nuanced. It's to say we did some testing, but given the size and scope of some of these features, we knew that they would necessarily be long-form plays. And so more often than not, what we did is we would build something, do our best to get, conformatory analyses around it. But a lot of what we actually spent up time doing was doing retrospective analyses about how all those levers and things worked out that were then used to inform the next evolution, the next set of features that would come out of that as well. And so, to say it's difficult to confirm because it's expensive to build, but it is not difficult for a team to build a culture of always asking themselves, was it good enough? What should we have done? And now that we know how players do engage with it, what is the next iteration in Rev that's going to make it even better than the time?
Got it. So if I'm understanding correctly, like for this specific application, let's call it feature validation, you have a set of hypotheses and a type of thinking around your personas. And then as you build a feature and as players come in, then you kind of like what you call retrospectively kind of testing to see if your thinking and analysis were correct or not. And then by doing that, that helps you then think about future features and how you think about features in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. Correct? It's also a good way for us to then also say, do we need to go back into that feature and make changes? I would say like, and for players that have been a part of the Galaxy of Heroes experience for a long period of time, we released what we refer to as the Grand Arena Championship, which was, we've actually have multiple revs of PvP tournament systems inside of the game. We had one that was originally just called tournaments. We boxed that. It didn't work the way that we thought it was going to. We took another shot at it. And I think that, you know, if there's, for anybody that's listening, you know, I would say, you know, the best part about live service is that you always get to be making it better. And so we always, so not only is it retrospective to what other future features we could build, but it's also retrospective of like, what else do we need to do to make this thing work in the ways that we think we want it to.
Got it. So like applications I'm hearing from you are feature validation, kind of feature optimization, where you can go back and make features even better potentially. And then you had also mentioned marketing. So like how you would market to new players for the game. And is there any other application I'm missing, or are those the primary ones?
I think that those are the big ones that I would call out. I mean, I think feature validation, I think that there's also a part of that. No, let's again, I'm probably being too nuanced with it. I would say that those are probably like those are the big pillars I would point to right now. Yes.
Okay. And Josh, would you agree with that, or would you add any other applications? What do you think?
I think Nick has captured pretty well some of the primary applications there. I would just add ideation. I think personas can actually be very helpful in the ideation stage as well. So a lot of teams maybe have a concrete, you know, broad idea of what they're looking to. But actually, as Nick pointed out, what can be really helpful is to take those kind of data-based personas and either challenge your assumptions, confirm those hypotheses, or, you know, deny them as well. What's been really helpful and what I've seen work very well in the space and with people that we've worked with personas on is to take just sort of a basic concept. Maybe they understand, you know, the general direction in which they want to head, but they're not really sure about what the specifics look like. And then bring in that data-backed persona to really flesh out what a full, kind of like Nick mentioned, feature scaffold could look like. It's not so different than what Nick was pointing to. I would just say maybe sometimes it can be brought in even earlier in the process. This is what I love to see. I mean, it's probably no surprise that as a head of UX research and user research, I'm very, very invested in user-centered design and human-centered thinking. So to bring that element of the audience for which you're working in first and then actually craft features around them, I think is a very useful thing that we sometimes miss with the persona work that's being done nowadays.
Right. And Josh, so I understand what you were just saying when it comes to ideation, but you mentioned data-backed persona. But if you don't know what you're making yet, how do you have a data-backed persona? Are you trying to take a persona from an existing game that you think is lucrative and then trying to take that persona and then try to determine what features or what kind of a game would make sense for them? Or can you go into a little bit more depth in terms of how that works for you guys?
Yeah, happy to. So we work with one of our tools called Navigator in this space. And what that does is it's often oriented on whatever you would like to focus on. It's important to think about the fact that people are more than just the games they play. So oftentimes we're actually pointing people who we work with towards things like, are you creating this for football players? Are you creating this for people who are very into horse riding? Are you creating this for people who are very into maybe more magical realms, similar to things like Lord of the Rings and spaces like that? So it's not that we want to, you know, hone in on solely what games have made money in the past, but really find a target audience in a very broad sense. Some people come to us with a very clear idea of, we would like to create a MOBA, and then we could actually pull data from our database of existing site personalities, our profiles, and craft an audience, you know, around MOBAs. But we also have people come to us and say, I'm really interested in creating any sort of game for people who are into gardening. I just feel really like there's not enough gardening games. And then we would pull profiles who have stated that they're interested in gardening, and you start to get a really interesting lay of the land of the different sort of psychological profiles in that space, and then can create a game accordingly. Now, I would say that 9 times out of 10, a game development team has a very clear idea of what kind of game they want to make. So those examples of like the gardening space or, you know, people who are into horseback riding are probably more the exception than the norm. But whenever a game team has a clear concept of what kind of a game they're making or in what space they're making it, we would also pull data based on games from that space to then craft that kind of audience to begin with. It's still very high level, mind you. So again, if somebody comes to us and says, hey, we'd like to create maybe a MOBA in a particular arena, so maybe like a space MOBA, let's pretend that's what somebody's come to us and said, we could pull profiles who have shown interest in MOBAs, in playing MOBA games, but also in, you know, science fiction or space exploration, and then craft an audience accordingly. And that is really what I was pointing to with that ideation, is I think the earlier you can bring in that persona data and that kind of target audience data, the more you can challenge your own assumptions, but also kind of get a leg up on what is going to resonate with people. It goes back to what Nick was saying. Good science is having a hypothesis, testing that hypothesis, challenging it, confirming it, and then kind of, revising accordingly. So personas are often brought in a little bit late in the game, in my mind, when they could be brought in really even at that hypothesis crafting stage to inform what kind of a hypothesis you're crafting at all.
I just want to hop in. During our exploration and prototyping, I still think we probably could have been even earlier on it, but by the time we were able to get everything secured and working with Solston, you know, one of the things we did was, again, we were trying to blend genres in a way that hadn't been done before. And so a lot of that was like trying to parse that, and that along the different, and it's not to, and again, I love their product. It's also not to say that like it answers all questions, but what I would also say is that what was really nice is that the granularity and the breakdown, the discreteness of like where there were overlaps and where we were able to like take one group that we thought wanted X mechanic and another one that also was interested in Y. And what we started doing was we looked for the places where we were confirmed, and we spent way more time in saying, what are the places where it's different? And is that difference fatal in the way that we think about building out this product? And so what we ended up doing is spending a lot of time thinking about that. And so it was all well and good to be like, yes, yes, that's great. We were right here, here, and here. But we actually, as I think so often is the case in really well-functioning live service teams, they care very little about what they're successful about. Where does it fail? How does it fail? How hard does it fail? And again, what does it mean for us then to adapt? And I would say that we were at, and that prototype, it's not dead. It's shelved for the moment due to other sort of pressing business needs. But we were at the point where we were starting to reorient some of our core observations based off of that personality and survey data that was coming in from Solston. Well, again, not survey data, but instrument data coming in from Solston, and rethinking about like what are some things we could pump up specifically. Like, and again, I work in a lot of like semi-competitive games, and it was a lot about what drove competitive drive in those games, and making sure that they were going to line up in a way. And so, anyway, it's just to add a little bit more color and say that I think that was my first time using personas that early in prototyping, but I think it was really effective in where we were headed towards it.
Great. And for some of the folks in the audience who have not used personas before, who may be thinking, well, okay, sounds like there are, you know, different applications here that you can apply personas to, but what is it? How impactful is it? How much can it help me in terms of success or failure? And I know, Nick, in your case, I don't know how much of the success of Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes you can attribute to personas or not, but like, can you guys give me a sense of just like, how important is this notion around personas? How big of an impact can it have on a game? If you were to, you know, rate it on a scale of 1 to 10 or something like that, how would you guys characterize the impact and importance of understanding how to use personas in the right way?
I'm happy to jump in here, mostly because I would actually point to something Nick said earlier, which is at the core, it's about the culture you build, right? With both the leadership team, but also your development team. I think personas can fall squarely on any number on a scale of 1 to 10, right? And for the record, I actually prefer 7-point scales, but I'm not going to go into that. But I think the utility is really in creating a culture within your development team of looking to the human who's playing the game. And if you've crafted that culture, personas can be massively impactful and massively useful, right up there, like a 9 or 10 on that scale. If you don't have that culture of really thinking about the player who's engaging with your feature or with your system, to be honest, they're not going to be as useful, in part because people will be working off of something like assumptions. Now, where there's an in-between is challenging that kind of approach to game design, to things like marketing. Where I have absolutely seen personas thrive is in this data-backed space, right? Where there's science, where there's data behind who a persona is and what the persona breakdown is of an audience. That can be really productive in kind of turning around a team who has maybe before focused on working off of assumptions and, you know, guesses more or less, to then thinking through things from a more data-driven perspective. So all that to say, it can fall kind of squarely anywhere on that 1 to 10 scale. I think that they can be extremely powerful, and they're certainly powerful in challenging people to think about who is the audience really.
Nick, if you couldn't use personas when you were working on Star Wars, would it have been successful or not?
It's hard to find any sort of unequivocal lines. I'm not sure we would have been as successful. And so, and again, like not to skirt the question too much, it's just to say so much of the first 3 to 4 years of feature development in Galaxy of Heroes was driven by some very core foundational observations we had about the types of players that we had coming in that I don't think it would be anywhere near successful. It was a very successful, it still is a very successful game. And so, I think that, again, thinking about it in terms of life cycle, we had a very early vision about what the game would look like. And as it would, and while we couldn't say this is what it's going to look like in year 7, year 8, et cetera, those things were so foundational to our success that I think it was really critical. But I really wanting to be a pitch on to what Josh is also reinforcing on is just to say, this is all about the teams having it be a part of it. And I think that, like, you know, something our team has walked a very good line on is that there's this, like, you know, some teams are only driven by data and some are only driven by design and like sort of like big concepts. And both are functional ways to run teams. And what I would say is that what I'm proud of the work in Capital and the leadership inside of Capital Games is that I think it does a really good job of being data informed, but creative driven. And that, like, we take all that in, we really try to think deeply about how all those things come together. And again, coming from a player and human perspective first of who wants this. I mean, like, ultimately, I don't, when I really think about the games I play gnarly, deep math, so like, you know, roguelikes and mean, like, I love Crusader Kings 2. I think it's like, but it's a mean game. It's not, it is not mass appeal in the way that we would think of as something like Star Wars. And so using personas and using a culture that that thinks about that in those ways is the way that you can create, I'll coin a phrase here and say a dispassionate eye towards fun. And it's to say, like, you know, to really look at it and to say, I, what am I trying to build for a group of people that aren't necessarily me that I think is going to really get them excited on a day-to-day basis? And because ultimately, it's cool to make the sort of game you want to make, but being able to make games for other types of people that anyone can enjoy, like, that's masterful. That's the thing that I think that a lot of times what my teams and I are always trying to struggle for, not struggle, but strive for, is how do we make those sorts of things? And so I guess this is an impassioned plea to say, yes, it was very important in Galaxy of Heroes, but it's very tied up in the culture. And that culture, again, has to have this sort of dispassionate eye for fun. It's driven by the efficiency of making great experiences. And how you get to that is really understanding who the players are and what they want to be doing.
Maybe we can circle back to this question around kind of this data-focused approach to personas relative to what some of the folks I know and some of the friends that I have who are taking more of a conceptually driven approach to personas, right? And so they'll just think very deeply. They'll have, you know, their different personas, and they'll have a lot of features oriented around those personas that they think about more conceptually. What do you guys think about that kind of an approach? How would you think about the trade-offs or the weaknesses, advantages of that approach versus more of a data-driven or kind of data-focused personas approach?
That is definitely an approach. Let me maybe put it that way. it's one way to start a project. It's a way to be creative about thinking who you could be creating something for. The misstep there is if you base all of your feature scaffolding, design decisions, user acquisition plans, marketing material, all of that on that kind of hypothetical, that potential, I really thought deeply about this, and this is who I feel could be in this space, you're not challenging your assumption. And what I think good game design looks like and good game creation looks like is challenging our own assumptions. It's creatively challenging those assumptions. What we miss by working solely hypothetically and solely conceptually and without data is the actual scientific backing to do that challenge, to really conceptually, like, to test our own hypotheses in that space. So it's definitely useful as a thought exercise. And I think that a lot of great games have come out of some really interesting thought exercises, but the best games have come out of those thought exercises and then challenged their own assumptions about who the game might actually be being created for. A great point of this is I actually struggled with this whenever I was working on EVE Online at CCP. That team is fantastic, but there were a lot of assumptions about who the core player was. And we worked really hard, actually, over time to work with our data team, with my team in UX research, and even our community team to understand, but who is the player base really? And we found out through a fair bit of effort and a fair bit of work, actually at the time working with Solston as well, that the people we thought were maybe the majority in our game were very much the minority. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't have stopped making the game and making features for them. It just means that there was kind of untapped potential in those players who had become veterans of EVE Online to play in a different kind of style and to gear content towards them. Now, I can't say too terribly really much more in that space without getting into NDA territory, but what's really important to understand here is that I, going back to that team culture, had an entire development team hungry to be proven wrong, right? They were very open to what the data would say. They were also happy to play in that kind of thought space and conceptually think about what kind of a player might engage with this feature, and then we would take the data and either prove or disprove that. And if we disproved it, it was almost better for them because then they could refine the feature accordingly. So all of that to say, I think that there is kind of an in-between here where it's important to start with a concept, and it's important to start with kind of maybe a hypothetical, but to bring data in as early as possible to round that out.
And Josh, just so I understand what that actually might look like. So let's say we have a game, an RPG game and there's a notion of a couple of personas, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just trying to provide a simple example for the audience to understand. But let's say you think that there are two personas, killers and explorers. And so you launch your game and now you're like, okay, well, are these two, like, how do you validate the personas? And then how would you try to determine what percentage of your audience is, you know, well, first of all, so the first question, you know, maybe those personas are right, maybe they're wrong. How do you validate that? And then how would you try to determine what percentage of your player base is one versus the other?
So I would start by thinking more broadly about personas to begin with, going into maybe that kind of deep conceptual space, right? Like, one thing I would hope that we're thinking about is beyond just the kind of Bartle types. Nick pointed out the Bartle types earlier. I think they're fantastic as like a good starting point. But one area that I think we could all grow in is to think a little bit more complexly or, nuanced whenever it comes to the kinds of players in the space. So I would probably start by even challenging, explorers versus killers as the persona types to kind of craft a game around. And then it goes to what I was saying. I would actually bring in the data that, either we at Solsten have or a team could create themselves to think about personas more robustly than that and to challenge,
Can you give me an example of that? Like, what would be an example of a more complex persona?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't go too terribly into it without getting overly scientific and complicated, but what I would look at is something that's thinking about that human from multiple angles. And what I mean by this is not just the motivational profiles of things like explorers and killers, right, which is a part of it, but also things like the personality side of it. So are they altruistic? Are they caring? Are they giving? Are they maybe a little bit more social? Are they more independent or introverted? But then I would also look at things like what resonates with them otherwise, what kind of IP is resonating with them. So what's important here is to think more beyond just a motivational aspect, but to try to kind of capture a persona broadly. And I would even start there. And then to your question about how do you validate that, we work with data. So we work with things like assessing live audiences to make sure we're challenging the crafting of those personas. But I also think you can get into some really exciting UX research territory here. Things like large-scale surveys are able to like at least craft a little bit of insight whenever it comes to who's within your game. I also think that it's useful to look at the power of statistics, as well as how we work with the teams like the data analytics team or the player behavior teams or even the community teams to understand what their grasp is of a particular audience. Okay. So all of that kind of, together would be, in my mind, the proper way to challenge that.
Right. And if I remember correctly, one of the things that you guys both have said is that a lot of personas are behavior driven. So one of the things you could potentially do is like, not to say that killers and, explorers are the right persona types, but you could see, well, do these people kill a lot of people? Are these guys exploring a lot or something like that? Would that be another way of trying to determine whether?
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to say. Just to hop in there and say, like, that's where my mind goes, is it's not to say like, look, being high concept or data driven, like I think that the reality is that good game teams, it's a sine wave. Sometimes you're more on one, sometimes you're more on the other, but that you should be moving between them. And so what it is to say is like, I think what ultimately, if we're advocating for anything, it's like using these tools up front cuts on some of the iteration. But if a team was to be like quote unquote highly conceptual, like all it really requires, and it's not to diminish, like all this takes is doing math, but it's to say, I think all it takes is then saying, okay, so they're killers. What the hell does a killer mean in our game? And then really starting to like, and that's more than one thing. That's never just like, oh, they kill people. Like that's not that. So it's that they kill, that they do 5 PvP games a day, and that they spend at least 30 minutes looking at gun loadouts, and they do X, Y, and Z. And even at that point, even if that's not based in, the work that Josh has done, or it's not based in like looking at player data or like starting from a player data perspective, it at least then begins you to orient yourself to say like, my concept is X. Are people doing what I think? And then again, this comes back to that notion of then you get to then live operate on your own internal model of how your game works and begin to update it and say like, oh, I think there's 3 types of people. I see more of my people doing more of this stuff. So like, what does that mean? And then just being able to ask yourself that. So all of these start from a place of concept. Even the thing I coined, like dispassion about fun, is really to say, like, but you may be dispassionate about fun, but rigorous and excited about the process to arrive to it. You bring not like just trying to bring in less of your own, like, I think the game should look like this, and more of just trying to bring in, how does it mean? What does it mean to get to the quote unquote truth, the cosmic truth that exists about this game? And so that said, I think a lot of times when we think of auteurs or people that are really good in like this conceptual space, a lot of times what they, in my opinion, and I don't know if there's any research about it, is that they have a finely honed sense of what is mass market or what will appeal to a mass market. And it's less, and it's not to say that they aren't special. They're special human beings in that regard, but it's that their brain does already some of that filtering and that work intuitively. All I think that we're trying to say is that not everybody has their brain wired that way, or that there are other ways to arrive to that same sense of truth, and that it can be systematized in some ways. In fact, you look at someone like I think one of the greatest game makers of all time. God, I hope that he listens to this. Is Sid Meier. I think you're a genius. I'll love you forever. But it's to say, he was just incredibly intuitive. Like, he didn't have all this data and everything, but he had just an incredible sense of what would be appeal at mass market. So yes, we can arrive to those things. The question for us is, as a set of businesses, as a set of game teams that are trying to arrive to that, what is the quickest way that we can arrive to those same sort of observations more quickly and do the good thing, which is then to start to operate on the game and make it better for our players. Spend less time in the woods trying to figure out what the hell we're even doing here and trying to bring ourselves more to servicing the people that have come to our game.
I think I got it. And one other interesting thing that I think you mentioned, Nick, is just like being able to describe a persona by a set of behaviors. So maybe you could even cluster behaviors, and then you may not know what, there may not be a specific name for it, but you could say, well, this cluster of players tends to do these activities. And then you could just give it a name 100%. Or something like that.
Earliest analyses around Galaxy before we got more rigorous and sort of thinking about personas and things were that. I would sit down and another guy would sit down and say, like, okay, this is the way like behaviors cluster out. We'd cut it in three or four different ways. And then we would literally just review the data and start telling ourselves stories about what was going into it. And then for each cluster, we had one or two prevailing narratives. And then we would begin to then say, well, if it's this narrative, then it implies these sorts of mechanics of how this group works. And if it's this narrative, then it implies that. And then again, we still don't really know anything in like a scientific sense, but we at least have a grounding for saying, like, maybe this is the way it's working. And so then when we would go to talk to our feature teams or our content teams and say, like, we think this is working, we could try X, Y, or Z. And they would say, well, we're thinking about A and B. And we'd be like, well, those two things are kind of, what's an experiment? And again, it doesn't mean that it has to be a formal A-B test experiment. It could be a natural experiment, i.e. we do a thing and we look at it after the fact. It could be that we just do it and let it rip and see where we go from there. Like, it's any number of things. But it is to say, by just even taking the step to beg that question, to go from, I think that there's killers and explorers, to, I think that a killer has these markers or potentially these markers of behavior, to now we're building some features as we think about those markers and how they like roll into it. Again, all we're doing, I've used this term, it's probably overly heady, but it's like just the notion of a causal logic model, meaning if we do A and B occurs, then C is likely the mechanism by which those things occur. There's nothing mathematical about that. It's just symbolic logic. That's all any of us do. And again, intuitively as game makers, a lot of times that's what our creatives are actually doing. This is fun. I think it will result in this outcome, and it's likely because of this mechanism that's driving it. And so, it's just the ways that we kind of get to that sooner as groups of people and have that shared mind space. And again, I think a lot of times what personas actually do is that they actually just create the common framework of definitions that by which we discuss the things. Right. And that's And again, you can do that in a very formalized way, or you can do that in a very, sort of intuitive way. But what's most important is that everybody is sharing that language.
Right. So to some degree, the notion of personas is creating these narratives around that explain clusters of behavior. Would you agree with that?
I think in its broadest sense, I would agree with that. Josh, what do you think?
I think, again, in the broad sense, I would also agree with that. And I would just plus one to a lot of what Nick has said in this particular space. I will say that what they're very useful in, to kind of just hit home something he mentioned, that is, we have some geniuses in game development. Sid Meier is a great example, Nick. There's other narrative designers out there who I think are equally on that plane of just naturally intuiting who they're building a game for and what needs to be fit into that kind of mass appeal. But that's not everybody, right? And where Personas help is to create a shared language around understanding some of those aspects of game creation.
And maybe, Josh, could you kind of step through what does a kind of persona initiative look like from like the start to the end? Like, what typically happens? How long does it take? What is that? If you could just give us like just one kind of example of what that would look like, how many people it would involve, just for people in the audience who have no idea. And that includes me.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I can give an actual example of me working with Personas on EVE Online. Yeah. I will say before I give that example, which is more tied to feature development, I think another utility of them is to create an empathy bridge between your development team and a potential target audience or a player base. I won't go so much into that example because it's quite nuanced and complicated and can be as short as like a couple day workshop to as long as, you know, a multi-month project. But I want to flag that that is a use case here as well for Personas, is to create empathy between a development team and a player base. Now, that's part of the work that I did with Personas when I was working at EVE Online. And I'll actually flag here that what we used them for was to challenge our own assumptions about the kind of player we were building the game for. So while I was there, one of our key focuses was to understand new players and to understand specifically how new players then grow to become EVE Online veterans. So we were looking to really capture what it is that motivates somebody to play EVE Online, but also what keeps them playing. What kind of a human have we attracted into this ecosystem? I think there's a lot of well-known sort of reputations about EVE Online. It's about these big, gigantic spaceship battles that cost multi-tens of thousands of US dollars, right, in virtual assets. That is certainly an aspect of the game, and that's something that we also operated on, was this assumption of this is what people are looking for from this game. There was some great research that had been done before to also highlight that actually friendship was what people were looking for, so that social connection. But we didn't understand that on a really nuanced level of what that means. So actually working with personas, and these were data-driven personas, we started with some behavioral personas. We actually clustered and captured different kinds of behavioral personas that existed in the space. And then we also brought in Solsten personas, looking at the psychological elements of it. We actually found some really interesting overlaps between our own behavioral personas and those psychological personas. We also found areas of distinction there. What we did with them then is, working as part of a new player experience team, I worked hand-in-hand with a narrative designer. Her name is Melissa Gray. She's a fantastic narrative designer, as well as a lead sort of game designer in the space. And we were trying to craft a new player experience. What we knew is we knew people wanted spaceships. We knew that they were interested in generally companionship in some form or fashion. And that's really about where it stopped. We also knew that people were willing to invest up to a certain length of time whenever it came to giving the game a chance. And that's the data we had. Once we worked with the Solsten personas, we realized there were actually a distinct number of types of people in EVE Online. I won't go into how many, but we found two that were particularly interesting, both because they had the most kind of revenue generation, but also because they were the largest population that we had not discovered or not really thought about at length. And what we realized with these two unique personas is there were distinct areas. One was a little bit more competitive. One was a little bit more actually collaborative in that sense. So they weren't looking to compete to dominate, but looking to compete to become a part of a group of people. But both were highly altruistic in a really interesting way. So when actually crafting the narrative of the tutorial, we worked to understand why people were behaving in a certain way with that tutorial. We had at first just kind of had this tutorial that was like a line through space. You fought a bunch of battles. You fought against some robots. There was some interesting stuff there. It didn't really do very well. People complained about it. They weren't particularly engaged. So working with that narrative designer, she actually came up with this idea of, well, Do you think people could be interested in having like a buddy who goes through this story with them and having more of like a you know, a narrative pool? And we looked at the personas and saw that actually, yeah, there's really high collaboration here in some of our target personas, and there's a really high social element. Let's see if that works with an NPC. So we introduced this and it did really well in testing. So not just A/B testing, but actual play testing. We saw that the engagement was very, very high. People still weren't completely sold yet. And so there was an element here where we were looking to understand, okay, well, what else could we add to the story to engage? And again, working with that persona data and working with our narrative designer who had this fantastic intuition, we realized, well, what if we add a kind of a sob story of sorts to this tutorial? And so we introduced basically this whole narrative where you begin in this space station that gets blown up, and actually you are trying to help evacuate a group of space refugees out of a battlefield in order to save them. And this scored extremely well when we looked at UX metrics and things like satisfaction and engagement. And it was all informed, again, by personas. What we challenged in that space was the nature of battle, right? So one thing that we were unsure about was, well, they have to win, right? They have to ultimately win the battle. But actually, what's interesting is when we looked at the personas, people weren't really caring about whether they always succeeded. They just wanted to be altruistic and collaborate. And so there's actually an element of that tutorial where you're forced to die. It works really well in Eve. You're forced to die a lot anyways. But we were a little concerned at the time of like, is this death going to be too impactful? Is it going to cause people to actually quit? And that's just not the case. And again, that was both informed by this creative intuition, like Nick mentioned, there's kind of this part of the wave. And also we would come and challenge that with the data or confirm that with the data and then go back to creative ideation. So that's really what, in my mind, awesome persona work looks like. I think it's this hand in hand of working data and creative design together to craft an experience that's really robust and informed by not only data, but also an interesting output and aspect on architecting an experience in the world.
Okay. And Josh, for you, it sounds like this initiative was you and a narrative designer. So two people, and then how long did it roughly take from start to finish?
I did not mean to make it sound that way, and to the team that is maybe
listening to this, please don't take it that way. They solved it.
It was just the two of us. Yeah, absolutely. No, this was a massive team effort. So I want to make it very clear that while it was maybe pioneered actually largely by that narrative designer and her producer, as well as a couple of the other game designers on the team, it was certainly informed by data. So one thing that we did really well is we started with actually, who do we want to make this for? And what kind of an experience are we looking to make? And is that the kind of experience our players are looking to have within this game? So it is not just a two-person effort. It is actually a multi-team effort. And the timeline for that was about 6 months to a year. So it took us a full year to actually get that together. That includes, though, all the way from like the you know, grain and seed of a thought up to launching this to be live in Eve, as well as multiple phases of testing and prototyping along the way.
Okay, great. And Nick, for you, in your experience, what does that look like for you? Is it similar in terms of like the timeline, the size of the team? Are there any kinds of persona types of initiatives that you can do kind of quick and dirty? Or is it pretty much, you know, 6 to 12 months with
no,
with
I mean, teams? So it's funny. We also had a new user experience that we worked through on Galaxy of Heroes using a very similar method. It started with a very small group. There was this notion of it. We then brought in it was like concentric circles, very small group, bigger group than the whole damn team is working on. And that was kind of like the way it worked for us. And so that's also satisfying because, like, again, that's how we make sure we don't do something stupid early. Like we get a good seed going, then we work out. As far as, are there any quick wins with personas? You know, it's a no. So for instance, and I guess what I would say is, like, if you went in and you were like, hey, yeah, now we know that people like, you know, tigers. Let's make a tiger character or something like that. Like, I don't know if that actually is really, like, you don't actually understand why it's working. It's more about building the reflexive knowledge of it that is what's going to give you quick wins. And so, again, that's why I keep coming back to, it's about the team. It's about it being sort of ingrained in the whole group. And it's not to say that all of your designers are, again, sitting down and doing all this all the time, or all your PMs are not doing something else. It's to say, by creating that shared space, then it does come down to a question of, I'll give you an example. Once we had a better understanding of some of the dynamics of some of the character creation in Galaxy of Heroes, it informed the way we thought about making characters from that point moving forward. So, like, can I point to, like, did we sit down and we're like, yes, this persona, like, how will they engage with, you know, Commander Luke Skywalker? That's not how we did. What it ended up being, though, is that because of the way that it split on how we understood players played with different characters at different times and where they wanted to allocate their time, it became reflexive. Oh, we're going to have it do this because we know they care about this, which is where this sort of behavior is occurring. And so, in the world in which I'm trying to sell teams like, and you should own a persona car, it's instead to say, you should invest early in your project, or you should invest whatever you can in the project about understanding and thinking about it. And then you as a team should start working out about how you want to talk and think about it as a group and how it's going to inform your decisions moving forward. And again, teams can pick various elevations of how much they want to be involved with that. But I think it's primarily about just making sure that, again, it's the common lexicon, it's the common vocabulary by which you talk about the problems. And that is then when it becomes quick wins. Again, and it's not to, I'm not saying anything bad about Solstice. Like, you can't just ring them up and be like, hey, so, well, let's go find a personality type for this. And like, now we're done. That's not how it's going to work. But again, we were able to take on and change our entire new user funnel and make significant improvements on it because we had invested all that earlier time understanding how and why players played our game and in what ways. And in doing so, that means that we could make, again, ultimately the point that Josh has been making again and again, we can make it better for the humans that are playing the game. Because ultimately, that's all we really want to try to do, is just try to make something that people are having fun. Like, we are bidding for people's mental space on their leisure time. There are so many places they could be spending it. And that ultimately, we're just trying to say, like, how do we entertain you best? We are entertainers by nature. And so we're just trying to figure out how we can be the best entertainers.
And I think I just have one last question, and which is basically around monetization or maybe even economy. And I think, like, in this current age with IDFA deprecation, it's become a lot harder to be able to target whales and to get high monetizers into your game. And so it would seem that a useful application for personas would be to understand how to optimize the type of monetization of your audience. And I'm wondering if there are examples or applications in which you can try to determine, like, the optimum form of monetization using personas or not. And we've largely talked about features, we've talked about marketing, but what about monetization? Are there any specific applications you can use personas for there?
I mean, I think the answer is yes, 100%. It depends on kind of in what ways you want to go down the rabbit hole with it. I would say, as like a first order principle, engagement yields monetization. So a game that is more engaging will necessarily make more money more often than not. Now, it's like there's two steps. The first is, can we identify people that we can intervene upon? And then have we written the right intervention? The first step there is make a game that people want to play, and you will begin to pay for part of that experience. That second step, though, like, yeah, it's going to come back to it. Now, I personally haven't delved into sort of some of the stuff that Solson's done. We've talked about personas. We talk a lot about the way that we drive monetization and thinking about, again, what is going to be a novel and delightful experience, and like, how is that going to be delightful for players as well? Because you don't just want it to be a transaction that just feels like, okay, well, you know, here you go, whatever. You want it to have pomp and circumstance and feel like it's relating to something more. So again, I tend to ramble, and my apologies. It's to say, your first order priority is engagement. With engagement and understanding who your players are, that's your base value. That's how you're going to make money to begin with. And yes, there are different ways that players want to monetize, and definitely that they want to, like, be a part of it. It is not just saying, like, part of it may be bundles or like the way you do your pack and store. But I also think it's tied deeply into, like, how does the core experience actually reinforce or improve the experience of monetizing relative to the game feature that you're playing in as well. And that could be after you lose a match, being served something that will help you, that could be an aspirational monetization thing to say, this could help you reach new heights, that is presented at the beginning of an experience. There's a lot of different ways, and that those are tied into different player types. So yeah, I would say yes, there is.
I would agree with everything Nick has just said. I think what is really important is to understand that engaging games are games that people pay for. It's kind of a no-brainer, right? It's kind of common sense. We'll pay for things we like. I think sometimes people lose sight of that. We pay for experiences that are engaging or that are satisfying for us. And we also are willing to oftentimes invest in things that are doing good or resonating with us in some really deep way. If we look at some sort of outside of games examples, right, the amount of money just spent on Taylor Swift's concert series is quite out there. If you look at reasons why and ask anybody who's paying that much money to go to that concert, it's because it's resonating deeply with them to attend that concert and to have that kind of connection with Taylor Swift. I know that's an odd example, but the reason that I give it is because that's really what we're trying to do in this game space. Like Nick mentioned, it's entertain, it's engage, it's create moments that are meaningful and resonant for the people who are playing our games. And personas can do that. Not only will they help you create that resonant experience, but when we also look at the kind of monetization features, whenever we look at the monetization flows, it's important to grasp how people want to be communicated with. And this is also a part of the data we work with, but it's important to think about, how does somebody want to fail or succeed? Is this somebody who wants to get it back up on the horse by themselves? Are they willing to kind of spend some money in order to not have to go to that challenge again? Now, this is really important to flag that what we do not engage with at Soulston, and what I highly discourage, is any sort of a dark pattern of manipulation in this space. It is very, very important to flag that games should be healthy. They should be created for the good of the player. And what we explicitly will not do is equip teams with the tools to manipulate their player base into paying more money. What we will do is guide you on a path to create an experience that is more resonant. And for any sort of mechanics that are tied to monetization, help show you what would a healthy form of monetization look like in this space. So absolutely, personas can be used to increase monetization, to increase revenue. But ultimately, what's going to do that is creating a game that stands apart, like Nick mentioned, is novel, but is novel in a way that is particularly engaging, feels tailor-made to the people who are playing it, and has some sort of give back to that player as well.
Okay, great. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. I definitely learned a lot here as a newbie to personas. And with that, maybe I can just as a final note, do you guys have any last words of advice or ways in which folks in the audience could contact you if they're interested in reaching out to you?
If people are more than welcome to contact me either at my work email, which is just josh@soulston.io, or feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn as well. I'm pretty easy to find there. Always happy to have a conversation. And my parting piece of thought would be that it's important to think from a data-driven perspective, but don't let that fully block your creativity. What we really like to encourage, and what I would encourage everyone to think about, is work with data and creativity together. Data actually unlocks creativity. It does not block it. It helps support it. And I think this is what's so exciting about where we're seeing personas kind of develop into, is they're actually augmenting the creative process. They're not stopping it. They're not changing it fundamentally. They're just helping encourage that and grow it even more.
Awesome. Again, thank you so much, guys. And for our audience, we'll catch you next time. Thanks, everybody.